You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt Lewis. Happy post-Super Tuesday.
Yeah, welcome to the DMZ, everyone. I got to say, Bill, great to be back in the groove here. This is our second consecutive week doing what we do best. Better, you know, it's really better than anybody else, let's be honest.
I mean, you're talking to all these CNN muckety mucks these days. Imagine though you're having a roundtable discussion. You're in your little box with eight other people on CNN, and you're probably saying to yourself, you know, this is just not right. This is not the same. This is not the same kind
sometimes
of
there's only
rapport that I'm used to.
Sometimes there's only four people, Bill. but either way, it's fun. But it's good to be here because you know, even the best TV show. The classiest TV shows do not allow you to talk for 45 minutes. Yeah,
the DMZ, DMZ's big league. Tremendous.
This is the classiest show, the best. And it's an honor to be here with you. And of course, post Super Tuesday, interesting stuff happening. And where do you want to begin?
Well, I noticed you wrote, you know, we've always kidded about your affinity for Rubio on this show, but you actually wrote on your Daily Caller blog that you voted for Rubio. You're being transparent
right.
with your audience. Although you had said you are now are you anti-Trump or are you never Trump?
I'll never vote for Trump.
You'll never
because I think
you will never vote for Trump under any circumstances.
I can't imagine any circumstances where I would ever vote for Trump.
Okay.
No, I can't imagine.
So you are saying, so you said before, if you're in a state where Cruz is ahead, vote Cruz. If you're in a state where Rubio is ahead, vote Rubio. You're in Virginia, so therefore you voted Rubio. And you almost pulled it off. It was real close.
Yeah. You know, in fact, I had the theory, I think we talked about it last week maybe, about the 1836 Whig strategy where basically you let Rubio win. If you're Cruz and Kasich, you let Rubio win Florida. You let Kasich win Ohio. You let Cruz win Texas. Turns out Cruz didn't need any help winning Texas, which is probably why the cooperation would never have happened to begin with. But yeah, I mean, I'd have to look at the numbers, but I heard that Kasich might have been the difference for Rubio, that Kasich might have taken enough votes from Rubio.
Certainly in Virginia.
In Virginia, in the Commonwealth of Virginia where I live, Rubio narrowly avoided, Trump narrowly avoided losing to Rubio there.
So is your sense now that what I have read is Trump... and I believe I saw this from David Wasserman, who was with Cook Political Report and is now with 538, that Trump won enough delegates to be on track to winning a clear-cut majority of delegates. You still have this rumblings of discontent in the Republican Party, but no consolidation around a Trump alternative. You know, Trump got three, Rubio got one. Kasich isn't dropping out yet, at least at the point of time when we're taping a Wednesday afternoon. And you got these big March 15th winner-take-all contests looming, including in Florida and Ohio and I believe Illinois and a couple others. If you don't stop Trump there, then you really can't stop him from getting a majority outright. Is your sense of... Washington conservatives, Washington Republicans, that there is resignation to Trump being the nominee, or is there movement afoot to play for brokered convention? Are people talking about trying to break into the Constitution Party because their nominating convention is next month? Senator Ben Sasse has talked about, because he's never Trump, he's talking about finding another option some way, somehow. That maybe this will be like 1860 where there'll be four candidates running and no one's going to get a popular vote majority. Are you hearing anything about what people are planning to do, or is there just resignation at this point?
Well, I think there's still, I think shock is maybe the better word. My whole point about the 1836 Whig strategy was to concede that you're not going to beat Trump, but you can deprive him of the 1,237 delegates he needs, and then you can have a contested convention. And I made that argument like 10 days ago or so, and I think it's becoming probably even more likely now. I don't think there's any brokers or any leaders who have any real strategy right now, but I do think that there is a consensus amongst people like Ben Sasse, people like me, who are sort of conservatives, that, you know, on principle, you just can't support Donald Trump because, you know, first of all, he's a liberal. He supports or has supported single payer universal health care.
We're not accepting him, by the way, just so you know. That's not our line.
Subsidizing Planned Parenthood, eminent domain, go down the list. But on top of that, there's the added benefit of, aside from having a liberal be your party's nominee, he will also bring with it the label that you're a racist. And this label will tarnish the conservative movement and stick with you for the rest of your life. So 20 years from now, when I'm making the argument that my conservative policies will lift more Americans out of poverty and bring prosperity and peace and joy to more Americans, somebody will say, oh yeah? Well, you supported Donald Trump, the guy who refused to renounce the KKK. So can't go there, can't do it, can't take on that baggage, and cannot have the conservative movement be tarnished by that unseemliness. And so, you know, it becomes, you know, supporting Trump isn't like holding your nose and supporting a guy like Mitt Romney, who's too moderate for my tastes, or just doesn't, you know, jibe with me. It's really defying your moral code. And so I just think you're going to see people who just simply cannot support Trump, will do whatever it takes to stop him at the convention, even if it rips the Republican Party apart. The coalition could come unhinged and possibly support, you know, a constitutional conservative as a third party nominee. This is really, I mean, we have the potential, Bill, for the conservative movement and the Republican Party to literally, you know, come unglued and for the coalition to split. This could be a really, really big story.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, as far as you know, there isn't a specific strategy that is leading people's thoughts right now. Because if you're going to pursue the Constitution Party nomination, you know, that's in the middle of April. So you need to start working towards that now. You can't just, you know, walk into the room on the day of the convention and expect to get it, because they got their own people who control things. If you want to run as an actual independent and get on the ballot without a party structure, you need to start collecting signatures in all 50 states now. I mean, the fine deadlines for many of these things are July and August, some earlier, but the requirements may be very steep, but it requires a lot of money, a lot of staff. You can't wait around much longer if you're trying to, if you're putting all your chips into the brokered convention basket. And technically speaking, they're brokers. I just mean you denying Trump a majority. Yeah. You got to go all in on March 15th and consolidate around somebody. So is the party going to get behind Cruz or get behind Rubio? Is there a specific thing underway, or is there still a lot of diffuse disgust, but waiting and seeing? Or I should say a fourth option, you know, would a Mitt Romney, you know, jump in now? You know, would somebody get in the race and say, run me as a write-in? You know, Jerry Brown got in the race in mid-March in 1976, won three primaries and then tried to make a stand at the convention. It didn't work. But, you know, is there anything like that you think is the leading strategy for the never Trump crowd?
No, and I think that's why we're in this. Like the fact that there isn't a sort of unified plan now is indicative of the problem. Like, there's never been a plan to stop Trump. There's never been, you know, this goes to my book, Too Dumb to Fail. There are no adults, there is nobody in charge, and there is no plan. And the fact that there is no plan is why we're in the shape we're in now. And the fact that there is no plan for the shape we're in now is just a continuation of the chaos that we've been witnessing in the Republican Party and the conservative movement, you know, in recent years. So I know about the same that you know, based on what I've read and theories. I mean, look, honestly, I feel like I've done more just to put forth potential theories and ideas than anybody who actually has any control. Like, I'm not trying to actually control any of this. And I've posited as many viable theories as the so-called, you know, leaders, whoever they are. I don't think they exist. It is a mess. It is an absolute mess. And so, look, I guess let me just get to this point. So I don't think people like Ben Sass and me and many others, but I'll just use the two of us. I don't think people like Ben Sass and yours truly have a plan to save the Republican Party or the conservative movement from Trump. I think we have a plan to keep ourselves and our reputations from being tarnished by Donald Trump, so that we can sort of have a government in waiting, a philosophy, you know, go underground and basically preserve conservatism, at least keep it from being tarnished or tainted by Trumpism. That is not a great thing that we ought to be, like, this is not something to be proud of. This is like, this is the least we could do. I think that's kind of where we're at right now.
If it was up to you, you were the power broker, you were the Republican Party poobah that could actually dictate the strategy at this juncture, which path would you take? Would you try to save the Republican Party and put all your energies into denying Trump those delegates, starting with March 15th? Or would you say, okay, this operation is rotten. There's no saving this shell of a party. We got to start over somewhere else. Let's do Constitution Party. Let's go independent candidacy. Do you think there is a path that seems the easiest path to take?
Well, no, it's obviously much preferable to preserve what we have. If I had carte blanche authority tomorrow, I would say, okay, guess this is how it's going to go down. Rubio is going to be the president, because I think he's got the best shot of beating Hillary. Kasich's going to be the vice president. So you've got Florida and Ohio. And guess what? Ted Cruz, you're the Supreme Court. You're going to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I guess you can't do that. I guess you can't make him the Chief Justice.
I actually had a tweet exactly along these lines after the South Carolina primary, where I said, Rubio goes to the Kasich, you be VP. It goes to the Cruz. Yeah, I'll make you Attorney General, and when the Supreme Court opening arises, I will put you in that slot at that point.
That would be fine with me, and I would say this is how it's going to be now. Don't get out of the race yet. We need to we're going to deprive, you know, because I don't think head to head, I'm not even sure that head to head Rubio could beat Cruz. I'm sorry. I don't even know if Rubio could beat Trump head to head in Florida. It's hard to game out or Ohio. Let's say Ohio, for example. I don't know if Rubio could beat Trump head-to-head in Ohio.
Kasich's in Ohio.
That's why you stay in the race. Instead of dropping out, you stay in the race until after Ohio. So what you do is Cruz and Rubio would turn on their get-out-the-vote operation, all of their volunteers, send them all to Ohio to work for Kasich. This is like desperation, bare knuckles, pull out all the stops. But I'm just saying, you gave me this like scenario where I have complete control of all the resources of the Republican Party, and I can tell people what to do. That is what I would tell them to do.
Right. Now, I'm seeing a lot on the right that Trump is manifestly unelectable, a disaster for the party, would disintegrate the core principles of the party. And I'm seeing more and more on the left, watch out for this Trump. Trump's got a psychic hold on the electorate. He's gonna sweep the Rust Belt. He's whipping up the white working class into a fervor. You know, Hillary has to watch out. Don't take this guy for granted. Can both of these analyses be correct?
I'm sorry. So one of them is that Trump is whipping up people into the Fuhrer. What's the other one?
Well, I mean, the Democrats think that Trump is a Clinton killer. You know, she's weak.
Oh, I see.
She's weak with white working class. She's weak in economic populism. Trump could barnstorm the Rust Belt. He can win Ohio. He could win Pennsylvania. He could win Michigan. He could win Wisconsin. He could win Iowa. The whole notion that I think both parties held after 2012, which is you can't win on a whites-only electoral strategy. You have to play with Latinos and African Americans. Trump is so awesome.
That was under the assumption. Yeah, I mean, that was under the assumption you had a normal political candidate, and Donald Trump's not normal. Look, I don't know if he wins or loses against Hillary, but I think there's a chance he wins, and I think there's a chance that he does turn out angry, disaffected working class whites in the Rust Belt who would never vote for Mitt Romney and beats Hillary that way.
But
my primary concern is not that Donald Trump can't beat Hillary Clinton. It's that if he does win, even if he does win, we have no idea how he's going to govern. He's a loose cannon. And furthermore, I think in the long term, the demographic destiny would be destroyed. So, yes, maybe in 2016 you can win by doubling down on more white voters. I say this in Too Dumb to Fail, but in the long run, that is political suicide. Because basically that would be really turning off all sorts of other voters, Hispanics, single women, millennials, urbanites, people who otherwise could, I think, find a conservative message appealing under the right circumstances. So I think there's some people who are against Trump because they just think he can't win this time. Like, my problems with Trump transcend whether or not he can win in 2016. I think it's possible he could, and I don't even care about that.
Fair enough. But can you win a whites-only populist strategy when it would seem you're going to lose something off of your right flank? You people like Eric Erickson saying I can't vote for Trump because he's not consistent on abortion. You have people like Max Boot saying you can't trust Trump to be commander in chief. I'm a conservative on foreign policy, but Hillary's better than Trump on foreign policy. And you got people like you and Ben Sasse that just call Trump an outright liberal and say he's anathema to the principles of conservatism writ large. He's going to lose something on the right flank, right? So if you're losing something on the, you could argue, well, you guys are the conservative elite. You're not the grassroots. But I can't believe he holds the entirety of the Romney coalition and only adds two-time Obama swing voters to win the general election. He's going to lose something on the right, and he's got to make up a lot more in the left in the middle if that's going to happen.
I think that it's possible that you could have Trump picking up new voters, the aforementioned working class whites who were frustrated and angry, and then losing mainstream conservatives and establishment Republicans. And I don't think most of us would. I couldn't in good conscience vote for Hillary Clinton either. I can't, I'm not going to vote for someone who's not pro-life. And so I don't think you're going to, there may be some foreign policy folks who that's their, neocons or whatever who go and vote for Hillary. But I think that would be, you could probably count them on one finger. And most of them are probably within a couple blocks of where I'm sitting right now. I don't think you're going to have a large, a huge number of conservatives who actually vote for Hillary. They may just stay home or vote third party.
Well, but staying home and voting third party is still seepage on the right flank that makes it hard for Trump to run a whites only strategy.
It certainly would take. I think the whole thing with Trump is you have to know. I mean, you're banking on the fact that he's a unique kind of candidate, that he's a game-changing candidate, and he's changing he's going to change the coalition. Like, this is a guy who is, he's a populist nationalist. He's not a conservative Republican. So you very well could have this even if the Republican Party doesn't come apart, you definitely could have a coalition shifting, where the Democratic Party loses what's left of their white men, and the Republican Party becomes almost exclusively a party of whites. And so I think that it's going to dramatically change things, even if we preserve our two major parties system.
So I know you're mostly focused on the tenuous nature of the Republican Party right now. But what do you have anything to say about what's happening on the Democratic side, or do you have questions for me about what you think is going on there?
I think we agree that Bernie when he lost Nevada, it was probably over for him in terms of realistically having a chance to beat Hillary. So what's his game now? What is he after? What does he get out of staying in the race?
Well, I've read a couple articles about this for Politico, and I'm getting some guff from Bernie supporters that I'm writing him off too soon, but the delegate math clearly is not there at this point. Unlike the Republican side, which has winner-take-all contests in some places after March 15th, they're all proportional on the Democratic side, which on one hand makes it hard to build a wide delegate lead without a lot of blowout contests, but also makes it really hard to come back from a delegate deficit because you can't pick up very much even when you're winning states. I mean, and Hillary on Super Tuesday had blowout win. She blew Bernie out in the South and put some delegate distance between the two of them, not even counting superdelegates. The whole superdelegate issue is a total non-issue that the Bernie folks are being very overly obsessed about because they're worried, well, what if Bernie has the most delegates and the supers come in and rob him? Well, yeah.
You think we could borrow, since Hillary's not going to need them, you think we could borrow those superdelegates?
Hey, you guys wrote your own rules. I don't know what you guys are thinking. but it'd be crazy to do that. It'd be crazy to have a guy who clearly had the most delegates. I mean, in a two-person race, having an outright majority of the most delegates, and then supers come in and steals it. I mean, then the party blows apart. On the Republican side, you might have a plurality of delegates with Trump, and then supers could say, okay, well, you're too crazy. We'll go with somebody else. That's a little bit more palatable. But in a two-person race, that's a total non-starter. But it's moot because he doesn't have the most delegates, and he won't have the most delegates. So, Bernie is just not competing in states with diverse populations right now. I mean, he gave it a shot. I don't think he's trying to be dismissive of the African American and Latino votes, but he gave it a shot and he came up short. And so the question you had is what is the game for him? It's the immediate game is to maximize the number of delegates that he can win so he can go to the convention and try to exert as much influence on the party as possible. He's basically made a decision. He's been independent his whole life. He's now trying to change the nature of the Democratic Party to be more of a small D, small S Democratic Socialist Party, to be completely in opposition to corporate campaign cash, to rid themselves of corporate influence and be a more pure economic populist right. party. So,
let me ask you this. It seems to me that Hillary is vulnerable. Hillary was vulnerable. I think that she could, if she beats Trump, it'll be because he drives turnout against him, that he drives Democratic turnout. I think that Hillary, though, is not a great politician. And if Elizabeth Warren had run, or Joe Biden, although I think Elizabeth Warren would have been tougher, could Elizabeth Warren have pulled this off, or did Trump, or did Bernie do about as well as you could expect?
Well, I mean, Warren takes the gender issue off the table, so in that respect, you might think she would do better than Bernie, and maybe she would have.
But has gender been an issue? Has gender even been an issue in this race?
There is a gender gap working in Hillary's favor. It stops at around age 35, but clearly with women above that are very strongly for Hillary, and maybe older women would not have that same allegiance if Warren was in the race. But there are two elements where Warren would have the same problem. The issue with African American voters in this race is that Bernie has been in politics for three decades, and has no experience working with people of color communities. That's not an insult.
Which is so weird because, as you know, Bill, I don't have to tell you about his early work in the civil rights movement. I mean, I know he's from Vermont. I know he represents Vermont as a senator, but it's weird that obviously early on in his life and in his career, he really was, you know, intimately involved in the civil rights struggle. Why did he not build more bridges with the African American community the last several decades?
Well, I mean, his whole career has been to prove that you can win more conservative white voters, white working class voters, with an economic populist message zeroing in on class inequities. I mean, it's partly born out of the state that he's in and what he needed to do to win in that state, but I think it's what he believes most sincerely. And so there's an element of assuming you're going to have the people of color vote for that coalition, and you don't have to go the extra mile to bring them on board. And maybe in a general election that is true, but in a primary election that is not true. And so to just show up in these states without having a long history of working with those communities with very ambitious proposals, you're talking with communities who have been burned for a long time. Who are not? I mean, this was
they've been feeling the burn. They've been feeling the burn for years.
Obama got knocked for these comments about the white working class back in 2008, but he was making the point that if for white working class communities who have seen promise after promise not be fulfilled, it's very hard to waltz in there and assume that your great economic ideas are going to work because they've been burned before. And so I think that similar dynamic happened with Bernie in South Carolina, and he tried to mitigate it. He found some high profile surrogates. He tried to stress his civil rights background in the 60s. It's a lot of catch up work to do in a very short period of time. Whereas the Clintons, worked in these communities when they were in Arkansas. Hillary had civil rights work in South Carolina from her younger days that she could draw upon. And they have the work they did while they were in the White House together. So she was just a more familiar face. And so Warren would have the exact same problem. She hasn't even been in politics for as long. And she's only been a senator for less than one term. So she couldn't just show up there and assume those voters would be in hand. And I think the second problem that she would have is that she has zero experience when it comes to foreign policy. And there is a commander-in-chief element to this race. I mean, and so Bernie's weakest moments in the debates were when he was getting foreign policy questions and he would just be pivoting back to economic matters and giving an impression that this was just not a priority issue for him. When you're running for president, I mean, it's not every voter. There are single issue voters out there or people who are more focused on domestic than foreign policy. But some people are going to say, look, I know I'm voting for the whole package here. I need someone who can handle the gamut of stuff that a president gets thrown at. What would Warren say about complicated issues like Syria or North Korea? She hasn't had the practice in dealing with that yet, and she would not get to just talk about economics the entire time. So I don't think it's a given that Hillary's weak and a better Bernie in the face of Warren would have overtaken her. I think Warren might have done better than Bernie, but you're seeing these blowouts in a number of states, and I don't think you can assume that a Warren would have magically made that up.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just want to get back to the convention angle here, because I think that's very important, because there's still a question of how unified will this party be? Democrats aren't in as bad a shape as Republicans, but there is a split that's emerged here. And Bernie, on one hand, wants to have as many delegates as possible to say, okay, you got the nomination, but I'm the heart and soul of the party. I have the youth behind me. You're moving towards my issue set. Let's put it on paper. Let's put it in the platform that we're going to break up the banks, that we're going to have single-payer health care, we're going to have free college. Maybe there would be some Hillary delegates who would be partial to that, even though, and so Hillary wouldn't necessarily be able to control the outcome on the floor. You might have a floor fight over these issues that would distract from having the usual stage-managed convention. And put Hillary in the awkward position of saying, do you disagree with your party's platform on these things? Are you really leading this party, or is Bernie leading this party? Which is why I think it was pretty relevant that Hillary won in Massachusetts yesterday. She wants to limit his delegate haul. And so to pick off a neighboring Vermont state, effectively split the delegates with him, I mean, Bernie is going to need something like 40% of the delegates if he's going to really make a stand and say, I am on par with you as far as what this party believes in. If he's coming with more like 25% of the delegates, which is what Jesse Jackson had in 1988, you can make a stand. It's not going to be as strong a stand. So there's that element to it. And then there's the vice presidential quotient, which is Bernie supporters are going to say, well, you should have Bernie be the VP, or you should have Warren be the VP. We're part of this party. We don't trust you, Hillary. You need something to show to us that you're, that we're part of this party. And both of those options are not people that Hillary's going to be that excited to get behind. I think there's a sleeper choice in there in Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who is just as populist as Bernie and Warren are, but he's in a swing state, and he endorsed Hillary early. And you're also going to have people on the Latino side of the equation who are going to say, you know, we need to show you're a diverse party. But if Trump's the nominee and those Latino voters are already in hand, that worry about the Rust Belt might prompt her to say, hey, look, I believe me, people of color, you saved me in Nevada. You saved me in South Carolina. I'm going to be there for you. But we got to stop Trump, and that comes first.
Got a few more minutes here, Bill. I do want to talk about the press. And, you know, Donald Trump has had kind words for Vladimir Putin, who doesn't treat the press terribly well, has said Trump has promised he wouldn't murder reporters. He said things like some of them are good, but 80% of them are horrible, something like that. Most recently there was an incident where a Secret Service agent at a Trump rally choke slammed a Time photographer to the ground. It seems that his sin was that he tried to leave the holding pen to photograph a Black Lives Matter protest taking place at the Trump rally. I wrote a piece in Roll Call observing the irony that it seems like you can jump the fence at the White House and go in, and go into the White House and suffer fewer consequences than attempting to dare to leave the press holding pen and take a picture of something. So not a huge story right now, but I do sense that there's like a growing animosity toward the press and that it could potentially be dangerous. I don't know that I would want to be like an embedded reporter, certainly following Donald Trump around at these rallies where he gets the audience, you know, worked up into a tizzy and, you know, says bad things about the press. I don't know where this is heading, but, you know, obviously I'm a defender of the media in the sense that, you know, we need the media to keep politicians accountable. And it bothers me a little bit, even though, look, I've been, you know, I think the press is obviously liberally biased and in many ways you could blame them for Trump's rise, all the free exposure and 24/7 cable news and all that. Anyway, I wanted to get your take on it, Bill.
I mean, I don't know. I have no point of disagreement with you. I don't want to see the press beat up or otherwise restricted. I mean, the fact that Trump's talking about, you know, making more loose libel laws so we could sue more newspapers is deeply disturbing.
Do you sense that the rhetoric aimed at the press? I mean, we've had for years the annoy the press, vote for George Bush, or before that, the nattering nabobs of negativism. I mean, criticizing the press has long been part of the rhetoric, but it seems, I don't know, maybe I'm more sensitive to it now, or maybe it's getting ratcheted up and more more potentially dangerous.
Well, yeah, so much of what's going on right now is a part of a breakdown of media institutions where people don't get their knee-jerk opinions put in check by thoughtful reporting because they pick and choose what they want to see and listen to. And they have such deep distrust that, I mean, I don't think this is a majority view of the country, but I'm sure obviously with some, if a reporter gets knocked down or constricted, I mean, we have this issue with the safe spaces with the protests where folks on the left were not terribly interested in letting media roam freely and report on what's going on. So there's a general distrust that's not solely on.
That's
the
a good
right.
point. Remember that woman at the college who was like, "Give me some muscle over here."
She just got fired.
To shut down the press.
She just got fired by University of Missouri just a week or so ago.
What did she have to do? What did she have to do to deserve getting fired? When, as a journalism professor, she tried to shut down journalism. What? I wonder what she did to actually warrant getting fired.
What was that? I mean, there was that incident, and then
she finally.
And then there was a second incident that was uncovered at an earlier protest where there was video of, and the two together, you know, they
Well,
they
let me just give you an example. I mean, Twitter is anecdotal, of course, but NBC News Trump in bed, Ali Vitali, who's a lady reporter for NBC, who she's the embed, covers Donald Trump. She tweeted something about Black Lives Matter protesters the other day, and somebody tweeted back, "Journalists' lives don't matter." Now, that's obviously anecdotal. That could be anybody. That's like an anonymous Twitter person. But follow her on Twitter, or just you get a sense for what she deals with all the time. At these rallies, it's not a pretty sight.
Well, and you're seeing some stuff on the left with the also anecdotal, you know, not blaming the Bernie campaign for this or anything, but there are people I think on the Bernie side of the equation who are blaming the media. The media's in the tank for Hillary. There's writing Bernie off too soon. He's gotten the rougher end of the coverage, and it's so detached from the reality. Hillary is the one that's got, you know, knocked nine ways to Sunday over the course of 2015. And, you know, the Bernie coverage now has gone south because he's lost things. I mean, that's where the coverage turned on Bernie. Bernie had great coverage after Iowa and New Hampshire. Got bad coverage after Nevada and South Carolina. But you know, people are just so prone to distrust that there isn't and because you can pick and choose, there's lots of, you know, Bernie takes that are not from professional journalists that give a completely cherry-picked view of the situation to say, you know, Bernie's more electable or Bernie can still win because of this and you cling to that and you don't look at the other stuff that goes against your preconceptions.
Here's what I want to ask you, Bill. About 5 years ago, when we first started doing this show, and I was a little paranoid about the radical left, and you said that if they tried to come and get me, take me away, that you were going to tell the world my story and rally to my defense. What happens if Donald Trump does, if he sends me to Gitmo? Are you going to...
Should this go the other way? Should I be more concerned?
No. Ironically, no. You're safe. You're okay.
Both liberal. I'll be protected.
Yeah, he'll be okay with you guys. You got the same position on healthcare, same position on a lot of things. No, I would be. I mean, the good news is, I feel like, you know, if George Will disappears, or if a tragedy should befall Jonah Goldberg, then you know, I'm not going to be at the top of Trump's list, but you know, anyway,
well, just something to
mull over.
I will withstand any tweet storm from Donald Trump to save you from unfair imprisonment, unless of course you're being really mean to Donald Trump and you deserve it, then that's a different story. But if you don't
he was very, very mean to me. He was not fair. He was very mean.
If you're gonna start using bad language about Trump, if you're gonna start, you know, telling lies about Trump, yeah. You know, then yeah, I gotta.
Well, then it's fair. Yeah, Then you're fair game. By the way, I forgot to mention that Trump also wants to change libel or wants to loosen libel laws,
right,
so that he can also go after people who write hit pieces about him. So anyway, we've got that. We've got that to look forward to as well.
Well, I think Trump can be beaten. I think it's going to be okay. I mean, maybe not by you guys, but I think someone's going to come along to beat Trump soon enough. So I think you'll be out of prison in 2017 is my guess.
Here's hoping, man. Here's hoping. I don't have to move to Canada because I don't trust their extradition process.
All right. Well, it's great to talk to you. Always nice to see you on special days like post Super Tuesday. We got more races next week.
Good to be back in the saddle. Stay tuned, people. Go buy my book, Too Dumb to Fail. Check out Bill's stuff at Politico Magazine and Real Clear Politics. And if you do those two things and you download Matt Lewis and the News podcast on iTunes, you'll be ahead of the game.
That's right. All right.
All right.
Till next week.
See y'all. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.